Kabul.
Shahanabad, Indian administered Kashmir.
Around the world with reporters.
Hundreds of Palestinians attended a rally in the east of Gaza City near the security fence with the Israeli regime to mark the anniversary of an arson attack on the Al-Aqsa Mosque in 1969. 54 years ago, the Al-Aqsa Mosque in the occupied Al-Quds was set on fire by an Australian Zionist named Dennis Michael Rohan in coordination with the Israeli regime forces. The rally was organized by Palestinian resistance factions. The Hamas movement vowed to continue fighting for the sake of Al-Aqsa.
This big event east of Gaza is sending a strong message to the Zionist entity regarding Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa today is facing a much greater danger than it did 54 years ago. We will continue our struggle and our fight to protect the Islamic and Arab identity of Al-Aqsa Mosque. Al-Aqsa is a red line that must not be crossed.
People also marched towards the security fence, which resulted in clashes with Israeli regime forces. Israeli forces opened fire at the peaceful protesters and injured eight of them.
On the 54th anniversary of the burning of Al-Aqsa Mosque, we stress that the Palestinian resistance will always defend it. We call on Palestinians, especially in the occupied West Bank and Al-Quds, to defend Al-Aqsa against Zionist settlers and forces.
Soon after the arson attack, the Israeli regime increased the Judaization and settlement building in Al-Quds. Palestinians emphasized that Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque will always remain at the heart of the Palestinian struggle against the Israeli occupation.
We will not allow the Zionist regime to continue its violations against Al-Aqsa, and we will use all forms of resistance to protect Al-Quds and Al-Aqsa. The Zionists aim to ethnically cleanse Al-Quds from Palestinians and to Judaize the holy city.
Al-Quds is sacred to all Muslims, and Palestinians consider it as the capital of their future state.
Palestinians say they are willing to sacrifice their lives for the sake of Al-Quds and the Al-Aqsa Mosque, despite the U.S.-Israeli plots against the holy city. Ashraf Shanan, Gaza.
The start of a 4D trip aimed at exploring new areas of cooperation and, as described by Malaysia's foreign minister, a step that reflects the country's commitment towards enhancing bilateral relations with Iran. With both sides already enjoying strong relations in the field of education, science and technology, and tourism, it seems to be time to take cooperation to the next level.
Malaysia, through our new heightened engagement with this region, including as ASEAN GCC coordinators, wishes to contribute positively to the current encouraging geopolitical dynamic in this region.
Iran's foreign minister echoed those comments, pointing out that the Islamic Republic attaches great importance to its relations with Malaysia as a Muslim country, and therefore their Joint Economic Commission will resume operations in Tehran after a six-year hiatus. Also, a meeting of the two heads of state will be held very soon.
We have agreed to hold friendly sports competitions, including also women athletes. It is important for Iran and Malaysia to cooperate as two Muslim countries in all areas, specifically producing halal food.
And while discussing issues pertaining to the Muslim world, the top diplomats did not miss the chance to strongly condemn the desecration of holy books in general and the Holy Quran in particular, proposing a ban on all Swedish and Danish goods.
During his four-day trip to Tehran, the Malaysian foreign minister will also be meeting with other high-ranking Iranian officials, while a meeting with private sector business owners has also been scheduled for Iran and Malaysia to explore avenues of boosting economic cooperation. Gisumi Shahmadi, Tehran.
Yeah. Ibrahim Bougali, the Speaker of Algeria's Parliament, who has made an official visit to Tehran in a meeting with his Iranian counterpart Mohammad Bagher Ghalibaf, discussed bilateral, regional and international relations during the meeting. Talking to reporters after the meeting, Ghalibaf said that activating the Iran-Algeria Economic Commission is high on the agenda of talks between the two countries.
The joint Iran-Algeria Economic Commission will start working soon to prepare the ground for bolstering mutual ties in the field of economy. The expansion of the shipping lines between the two countries and cooperation in the field of science was another topic discussed in the meeting. Since Mr. Bougali is also the head of the Islamic country's parliament, a virtual meeting was needed amid the desecration of the Holy Quran that has repeatedly been taking place in Europe these days. During the meeting, we emphasized that all parliaments of Islamic countries should have a serious follow-up on the acts of desecration, and all parliaments of the Islamic world should take a serious stance in this regard.
For his part, the Algerian parliament speaker said the visit was to strengthen his country's relations with brotherly countries, including the Islamic Republic of Iran, which Algerians have a lot of respect for.
We call for stepped-up economic ties between the two nations in line with political relations. Algeria has approved a new investment law that provides incentives to investors. We hope that Iran is one of the countries that could take advantage of this investment opportunity and that Iran's achievements will be developed with the lifting of sanctions. At the international level, fortunately, we are aligned with the Islamic Republic in many positions, and we hope that relations will be strengthened more and more in the near future. At the level of the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, we must do better, particularly regarding actions of desecrations that are done against Muslim sanctities.
The two sides agreed to accelerate cooperation in the fields of science, technology, industry, tourism, agriculture, and medicine, stressing on the fact that history has shown Iran and Algeria are friends of hard times. Aside from holding talks with senior Iranian officials, the Algerian parliament speaker, during his five-day stay in the country, is scheduled to visit a number of Iranian knowledge-based companies to explore avenues for strengthening ties in different fields. Salman Kujuri, Tehran.
The vice chairman of Pakistan Tehreek-e-Insaf Party, Shah Mahmood Qureshi, and party's former secretary general, Asad Umar, have been arrested by the authorities after being accused of misusing a secret official document. Under the country's Official Secrets Act, on disclosing the contents of a diplomatic cipher for political gains, the counter-terrorism wing of Pakistan's Federal Investigation Agency registered a case against the two former federal ministers, along with ex-premier Imran Khan. Khan was sacked from power in April 2022 after he lost a no-confidence vote in parliament. Since then, he has been accusing the United States of hatching a conspiracy with the help of his political opponents and the military to remove him from power through a diplomatic cipher. Khan is currently serving 3-year jail sentence after a court found him guilty in a corruption case earlier this month. He has also been barred from taking part in politics for 5 years. Just moments before his arrest late on Saturday, the former Pakistani foreign minister Qureshi condemned what he called a widening crackdown on his party by the interim government. He said that his party will knock on the door of the country's top court to ensure that the elections be held on time in a free and fair manner.
It was unfortunate that PTI leaders were being arrested and then released after an announcement that they want to part ways with PTI. The caretaker prime minister has said that he will ensure transparent elections. I would ask him how he will do so in such an environment. I would request the Chief Justice of Pakistan and the Election Commission to take notice and ensure a level playing field for PTI.
Political analysts believe that the upcoming polls would be considered as one of the most controversial elections in the history of the country in the absence of one of Pakistan's popular political parties, the PTI.
The chief of PTI, Imran Khan, is in jail. The number two of that party, the vice chairman of PTI, is also arrested in the cipher case. So it looks that the PTI is going to be in a very disadvantageous position in the coming elections. The PTI also claims that thousands of its activists and political workers are in jail and they'll be tried in the military courts.
In the light of the possibility that the general elections may be delayed due to Election Commission of Pakistan's decision to hold new delimitations, major political parties strongly condemned the ECP decision, warning that the unconstitutional postponement of elections could escalate into political instability and uncertainty.
According to the political commentators, if the current caretaker setup stretches beyond its constitutional tenure, a lingering period without an elected government could lead to military intervention in the cash-strapped country. Nasir Kazmi, Islamabad.
In Italy, August is the time when millions of people take their annual holidays. The large majority of the Italians travel to their favorite destinations with their cars. But this summer, Italians are grappling with record high fuel prices that may affect their programs, with the cost of petrol reaching a new record high for the 17th consecutive day this month.
Our lawmakers in that building over there, they are fine in their government cars paid by us citizens. Fuel costs more than €2 per litre today. This is pure madness. There is no reason for these hikes. It's just speculation.
According to official data, the price of fuel with standard quality reached €2.019 per litre on the highways earlier this week. Petrol price at some service stations has even reached €2.7 per litre. The last time when prices were so high was in July 2022, following the start of the war in Ukraine. The country's industry minister, Adolfo Urso, has blamed the rise in the prices of petrol and diesel to policies adopted by the Organization of the Petroleum Exporting Countries, also known as OPEC.
Nobody here is saying that the government's version is blatantly false. OPEC doesn't have anything to do with the spike in fuel prices seen in Italy. The truth is that huge amounts of crude oil are available these days, but our country simply doesn't have the refineries to process it. Each and every proposal to invest in new refineries is thwarted by the government's adoption of green energy policies.
The EU has imposed massive and unprecedented sanctions on Russia, as well as a ban on Russian oil imports over the war in Ukraine. This measure has severely affected the few refineries located in Italy. Fuel prices affect levels of consumer confidence. According to Italy's Bureau of Statistics, Istat, the country's economic morale plunged sharply in July.
This thing is slipping out of our government's control. Everything costs 30 to 40% more. At this pace, we won't be able to go anywhere in summertime.
Italy's main farmers association, Coldiretti, has warned that in a country like Italy, where almost 90% of the goods travel by road to reach the shelves, the increase in fuel prices will result in sharp spikes, over 30%, in the cost of fruit and vegetables. Max Civili, Rome.
Religious leaders from more than 200 different spiritualities and 80 different countries gathered in Chicago for the Parliament of the World's Religions, the largest interfaith conference in the world. Since 1893, the organization has brought together people of faith who are committed to justice, peace, and spiritual growth. A key conference was Faith Over Fear, Countering Anti-Muslim Discrimination, which aimed to connect, equip, and energize all people of faith for anti-racist mobilizations or in anticipation of a looming Islamophobic incident.
In the United States, which is where our focus is, it is in some cases
It comes in waves, but as we're now facing another presidential campaign cycle, we're keeping our eyes and ears open because we expect that anti-Muslim hatred will become part of the conversation in the public square, perhaps even in some of the political campaigns themselves.
In Sweden and Denmark recently, the Holy Quran was burned and defaced in appalling and unnecessary provocations, and with their governments refusing to intervene, sparking protests worldwide. Activists noted that if someone hates Muslims, they likely hate many others as well.
Not only do studies show that people that hold anti-Muslim views also hold anti-Semitic views, also views about immigrants and refugees, black and brown communities. And so we believe that in addressing anti-Muslim discrimination and violence, we're making an inroads to help people address other forms of discrimination and racism, especially within the United States, where our history of religious intolerance and racism intersect for Muslims.
The parliament is held every 2 or 3 years in different cities around the world, and it helps build relationships between people who typically wouldn't cross paths, and that has lasting positive effects.
When it comes to so many things are different from Islam, one of our core belief is that Allah made different type of people, and he specifically asked Muslims to go learn from the kind of people he made. They are all equal in Allah's eyes. We all are. So I would feel if I would be doing injustice if I did not talk to these people and learn about them.
Attendees said that seeing the range of the world's religious practices in one place, from Abyssinians to Zoroastrianism, produces awe, respect, and the recognition of mankind's indivisible unity amid a splendid diversity. The Parliament is a reminder that faith isn't a barrier, but the inspiration for cooperation, and that humanity's collective global problems will be solved by people of faith continuing to work together. Ramin Mazahiri, Chicago.
Tehran hosted a conference to discuss the effects of sanctions on the health of patients. Speaking at the event, Secretary of the Strategic Council of Foreign Relations Abbas Araghchi rejected the U.S. claims that medicine and food items are exempted from sanctions.
There might be such a thing on the surface, but in practice, the actions taken by the U.S. administration have imposed a strong sanction in this area. The U.S. sanctions against Iran cover a very wide network, and in addition to the humanitarian exceptions that they have apparently placed in the field of medicine, there are very detailed conditions by the Office of Foreign Assets Control of the U.S. Treasury Department in a way that makes their implementation practically impossible for pharmaceutical companies.
Many human rights groups have criticized the U.S. for cutting off banking ties with Iran through threatening the international banks with punitive fines by the U.S. Department of Treasury, which has led to a disruption in the accessibility of vital medical supplies for Iranian patients.
The most important report in this matter was submitted to the UN Human Rights Council last year by Mrs. Duhan, the special rapporteur on unilateral coercive measures of the United Nations. The U.S. and the West, self-proclaimed advocates of human rights, were against this reporter and even voted against the resolution to extend her mission. Even during her report presentation in September last year, they chose not to be present in the meeting hall. Self-criticism is not within their tolerance.
Although the U.S. claims that the sanctions do not directly ban the sales of medicines to Iran, they block every financial route needed to obtain drugs for patients suffering from diseases such as diabetes, kidney failure, hemophilia, multiple sclerosis, thalassemia, and leukemia.
Iranian officials have repeatedly condemned the sanctions against the Iranian nation as a crime against humanity, saying such unilateral restrictive measures have put the lives of vulnerable people at risk by hampering their access to medicine. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
In the limelight.
The Zionist regime has normalized the killing of Palestinian children.
And that is because the UN and the Western regime's inaction towards the heinous crimes committed by the Israeli regime. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Crescent International noted two Palestinian children, both 14 years old, shot by Israeli regime forces during their military invasion of Jenin refugee camp on June 19th, died of their wounds. Ahmad Sagar died the same day after an Israeli regime troop shot him in the abdomen. Sadil, the other victim, died in Jenin government hospital on June 21st. An Israeli regime troop shot her in the head as she filmed a military assault on her phone standing in front of her home. Jenin refugee camp is home to 22,000 Palestinians. They were forcibly displaced from their homes in the regions of Haifa and Carmel Mountains in 1948 and have been denied since then the right of return in violation of Article 13 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. Jenin is cramped. It is tightly packed where Palestinians have to negotiate narrow alleys and warrens to reach their houses. Most other Palestinian towns and villages are no different as their living space shrinks under the ever-expanding illegal Zionist settlement. Defense for Children International Palestine said in a statement on June 21st, both of these children, Ahmad Sagar and Sadil, were shot and killed by Israeli regime forces in broad daylight, demonstrating that Israeli forces enjoy complete impunity and have no fear of repercussions. Killing Palestinian children has become so routine that Western rulers treat such murders with a hotly repressed yawn. If an Israeli regime soldier is killed or harmed, Western rulers go berserk. They demand that the culprits be apprehended and punished. When the Zionist regime perpetrates crimes against the Palestinians, Western rulers in unison parrot the line, Israel has the right to defend itself. No such right is afforded to the Palestinians who are under occupation. International law is clear. People under occupation have the right to resist their occupiers by any means necessary. Western regimes conveniently ignored this rule when it comes to the rights of the Palestinians. In their formulation, Palestinian lives do not matter. Only Israelis' lives do. According to a June 12th report in the Israeli newspaper Haaretz, Israeli forces and settlers killed 28 Palestinian children this year. Add to that the killing of two Palestinian children in Jenin, and the number surpasses 30 children this year killed already. Following the Zionist regime's now routine bombing of Gaza Strip on April 7th, in which a number of children were killed. The heartbreaking story of two-year-old Mohammad al-Tamimi stands out as a shocking example of the Zionist regime's brutality. Shot in the head by an Israeli regime force on June 1st, the infant died 4 days later of his injuries. Killing Palestinians in the West Bank and Gaza Strip has now become routine. Last year was the deadliest since 2005. When the largest number of Palestinians were killed. This year has already surpassed last year's gory record of killings. The Middle East Eye reported, since the start of the year, Israeli regime forces and settlers have killed at least 170 Palestinians, including 25 children. Providing a breakdown of fatalities, the Middle East Eye's report said that 134 Palestinians have been killed in the West Bank and East Al-Quds, and another 36 in the Gaza Strip. The West Bank killings included three Palestinians killed in a drone strike on June 21st. The Zionists have targeted Jenin and Nablus in the West Bank as well as East Al-Quds. The tiny Gaza Strip, besieged from all sides, is subjected to regular Israeli regime bombings from the air as well as missiles and artillery strikes. Jenin and Nablus are targeted because they have emerged as centers of resistance. Palestinian youth residing in these two locales are absolutely fed up of Zionist crimes. They feel that if they have to be killed or maimed, they might as well go down fighting. The Zionist regime's army's June 19 attack on Jenin was typical. It resulted in the killing of six people, which 91 were wounded. At least 31 of them are in critical condition. Two children were also shot and killed. One the same day and the other 2 days later. True to their dishonest nature, Western media outlets refer to the Zionist regime's murder of Palestinians as clashes. In an analytical piece, Al Jazeera columnist Belen Fernandez exposed the Western media fraud when she wrote that calling Israeli killings of Palestinians as clashes is to equate the neck and the guillotine. Meanwhile, the website of the New Arab wrote the UN repeatedly excluding Israel from the list of regimes that commit violations against children is deeply hypocritical, given the Secretary General himself has described the hellish lives of Palestinian children in Gaza. If there is a hell on earth, it is the lives of children in Gaza. These were the words of Antonio Guterres, Secretary General of the United Nations, during the May 2021 Israeli regime bombardment of the Gaza Strip. It is a stark statement, leaving no question as to the brutality and violence experienced by Gaza's residents, about half of whom are children. The United Nations General Assembly created the Special Representative of the Secretary General for Children and Armed Conflict following a 1996 report that comprehensively documented how children are disproportionately affected by armed conflict. Since 2001, the mandate of this office includes what has colloquially been called a list of shame, naming perpetrators that kill, harass, and otherwise threaten the lives and well-being of children. However, what was both surprising and yet utterly predictable was exclusion of the fabricated regime of Israel from the list, a list compiled by Guterres, considering the same report outlined the multiple attacks on children committed by both the Israeli regime military and by Zionist settlers. In fact, even with decades of documentation of the Zionist regime's violations of Palestinian children's rights, including countless reports issued by the United Nations itself, the fabricated regime of Israel has never been included on the list, despite the inclusion of other parties whose violations do not reach the scope of the Zionist regime's.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.
Joining us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.
Hello and welcome to Press TV Spotlight. I'm Marzia Hashmi. Thanks so much for being with us. Well, lots of eyes are on Johannesburg, South Africa these days as President Cyril Ramaphosa hosts the 15th BRICS Summit. Now, BRICS is an economic organization made up of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. It represents 40% of the world's population and 25% of the world's GDP. And the BRICS organization is definitely growing. More than 40 countries have shown interest in joining the bloc, and 20 of them have already applied, including Iran. But why? Stay with us as we take a closer look at the BRICS organization on this Spotlight. Well, I'd like to welcome my guest now to the program. Emmanuel Mutombo, international affairs researcher at the University of Johannesburg. I'm Johannesburg. And Wesley Seal, international relations expert out of Cape Town. Well, thank you both for being with me. I'd like to start this off in Johannesburg with Emmanuel. How significant is the current BRICS summit being held in South Africa?
Well, thank you very much. Good evening to you, and good evening to Professor Wesley Seal as well. The 15th BRICS Summit is very consequential for at least two reasons. The first reason is the influx of countries that have expressed interest in joining the BRICS. They indirectly testifying to the fact that it has become an increasingly consequential group of countries in the international system. The second reason why this BRICS summit is quite important is that it is the first time that the participants are meeting in person after the onslaught of COVID. So they'll probably try to look at how well the economies have recovered and try to map the way forward. But obviously, lurking in the background, the elephant, or to use the Russian nickname, the bear in the room, will be the conspicuous absence of President Vladimir Putin. But those are just some of the reasons why this 15th summit is quite consequential.
Well, Wesley, what has changed that so many more countries are interested now in joining BRICS, in your perspective?
Well, I think that there are a number of reasons. I think that no doubt the war in Ukraine has played a significant role, and the shift that conflict has caused within geopolitics. I think that many countries have seen that the bullying by the West certainly is not appetizing to them, and so they are willing to join this bloc of countries which have changed geopolitics. And so we've seen certainly in the last 30 years the demise of Western hegemony, and that shift that has taken place has certainly been attractive to other countries, especially those in the global south.
Well, Emmanuel, what about the makeup of BRICS? I mean, we have some members who are close allies of the United States and some who are adversaries. I mean, your perspective, can these countries effectively work together?
Yes, indeed. First of all, let us look at when the BRICS, the acronym itself, was coined in about 2001 by Jim O'Neill, an English economist. We should never forget the fact that when this group was founded, or when Jim O'Neill put these economies together, his raison d'etre for doing that was their economic influence in their respective regions. It had nothing to do with politics. Even today, Jim O'Neill himself is actually quite aggrieved at the fact that it has become so politically effective. So in terms of economic prominence in their own regions, that is what has actually made these countries to work so well together. In terms of politics, obviously there are a lot of divergences. India is usually talked about as being the biggest democracy in the world, and then China just next door. I read a newspaper, an article today in the New York Times that described China, on the other hand, as the biggest authoritarian government. So how then have they been working together? Because no one can actually pretend that India and China are bosom buddies. They don't see eye to eye on many issues, but their unifying factor is just the influence that they have as regional powers in their respective regions. And on top of that, obviously, they offer some semblance of being a counterweight towards the G7. So that is actually more unifying than the political divergences or chasms that are so much patent to everyone. The case of South Africa here in Africa is kind of seen, because South Africa is a stable, it's a stable democracy. It has some moral authority that dates back to the years when Nelson Mandela was president. So yes, those political underpinnings there do not really infect the economic foundations on which the BRICS was actually established.
Well, Wesley, with growing interest by some countries to become BRICS members of BRICS, is it a sign that these countries want to distance themselves from the United States, or is it that increasingly these countries just want to basically prioritize their own interests over those of Washington? I mean, how do you see it?
Well, I think that firstly, it's looking for what is common among us. And I think that for long, countries in the global south have sort of said we need to work together. I mean, this goes back as far as 1955 in Bandung. And successive attempts have been made from the global south, countries in the global south, to actually come together and work together practically. For the first time, I think, since Bandung, you've got a chance and an effort by global South leaders, where leaders in the global South are suddenly becoming the leaders globally, China, Russia, India, for example. And so this is important for countries, and they're seeing the shift happening. And I think that it is a matter of making sure that those of us who have much more in common, developing countries, are standing together, and hence the interests to join the bloc. Because fundamentally, each of these countries in the bloc, with maybe the exception of Russia, would describe themselves as developing countries rather than developed countries. And I think that that is appealing to countries around the world, especially if they are developing ones.
Emmanuel, I want to look at some, because there is a lot of countries that have applied to become a new member. I want to talk about Iran and what it would mean if Iran would become a member of BRICS.
Let us look at the economic promise that Iran comes with. It has untold reserves of energy. So based on that fact there, then yes, Iran could actually be a very important addition to the BRICS. But based on the commodity hunger that seems to permeate the developing world. Politically, unfortunately, Iran is a very controversial country, and to some extent, it might actually dent the profile of the BRICS. Now, we have seen that China is politically controversial, but that is more towards the West and the United States in particular. Iran is controversial even in the developing world. Iran is controversial even in the Middle East itself. So that might actually be a problem for the BRICS, especially if it does not only want to characterize itself as a group of emerging powers, if it also wants to characterize itself as a moral authority amongst the emerging economies, then yes, Iran would be a very controversial addition.
Okay, well, let's talk about the potential of BRICS in general, Wesley. Because we've talked about these countries, you heard in my intro about the 40% of the world's population is part of this, 25% of the world's GDP. I want you to touch on the potential of this organization.
Well, I think that I would slightly differ with my brother Emmanuel in Johannesburg in saying that the potential of BRICS lies precisely in the appreciation of difference. within the group. Emmanuel has pointed out, for example, the political differences within the group, and there are vast political differences within the group. But I think that it is for the group, the potential of the group is to sort of say to each other, look, we are not going to treat each other like the West has treated us. And that is precisely why a country such as Iran, I think, would make a perfect fit into the group. So I think that we must have a different approach than saying you and not you. And I think that the potential lies in that, so that we are able to say whoever wants to. I mean, we are told that 40 countries have applied to join the group. And I think, I mean, that goes bigger than the G20, for example. And so I think that the potential lies precisely in that, that we are forming a different and alternative global order, and that nobody is actually excluded and nobody is told, well, you're not going to fit. As long as you are appreciative of difference, appreciations of national sovereignty, the values of BRICS countries, I think that any country would be able to join and therefore exploit that that potential. And as you've pointed out, a quarter of the global economy, 40% of the world's population, a fifth of global trade, currently in the group. If you have an Iran joining, if you have an Argentina joining, if you have a number of other countries, as small or as big as they may be, I think the potential just grows with the more countries that join.
Right. Well, Emmanuel, members of BRICS have been working on creating a common currency. Tell me about the possibilities and challenges if this happens.
So first of all, we have to go back to the to 2012, when the idea of the currency reserve, the contingency reserve arrangement was mooted in Brazil. And then in 2013, the BRICS put up a study group, so to say, to try and explore the ways through which less dependency on the dollar could be established. And then in 2014, we saw the creation of the new development bank. And then befittingly now, Dilma Rousseff, the former president of Brazil, has been appointed as the president of the new development bank, otherwise known as the BRICS Bank. So those are just some steps that have been taken to lessen the global dependency on the dollar. So some momentum has been built up, but obviously that will take a long time to totally de-dollarize the trading facilities. Current figures, if I'm not mistaken, say that 88% of global trade is still being carried out in United States dollars. So yes, it would be a very long process in terms of disengaging the BRICS countries from the dollar. But obviously, the BRICS countries could take comfort from the fact that there has been a lot of countries with massive resources, such as Iran, that we've been talking about. We can talk about Argentina as well. We can talk about Algeria. We can talk about Kazakhstan as well. These are countries that bring with them consequential economies with massive resources that they are behind them. So those are some of the facts that could actually bolster the BRICS in its quest to de-dollarize their trade. But obviously, that will take a long time.
Well, Wesley, your thoughts on that. And do you see BRICS in general as becoming a viable option for a multilateral world and the beginning of the end to hegemonic actions under the so-called rules-based international order?
Well, I don't think the end of rules-based international order. I think that, if anything, the messages that we've certainly got from President Xi Jinping, even today, and President Ramaphosa, is that multilateralism must be emphasized and strengthened. And I think that one of the certainly the victims, as it were, of Western hegemony in the last 40 years has precisely been multilateralism, that you've had unilateralism from the West. And the West imposing, going into countries, etc., etc. So I think that the rules-based order will certainly be firmed up more than done away with completely. Yes, it is going to, we are seeing an alternative global order shaping and taking form. But again, as Emmanuel pointed out in the beginning of this interview, this summit is important precisely because of factors such as the de-dollarization process. That is what we are aiming towards, and that is what we are, as President Putin said, the process has started and it is irreversible. And I think that that is, if anything, that scares the West the most.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
Well, Emmanuel, can BRICS become a geopolitical rival of the G7 countries?
Well, I think to use the word rival that presupposes that the BRICS is reactive rather than being proactive. If we look at its background, I think it is a group that was formed by like respective associations of being emerging economies in their respective regions. So it would be negative to construe it merely as a rival to the G7. We should remember, by the way, that up to 2014, Russia was actually a member of what was then called the G8. So what is of utmost importance at the moment is for BRICS to be proactive in the developing world, especially itself, to create synergy. If we talk about international or global justice, then groups such as the BRICS should be the ones to bring that about, because most of the lopsided nature of international realities today are usually blamed on the developed countries, which are typically Western, which are typically more industrialized, the countries that characterize the G7. So if the BRICS is merely seen as a counterweight to that, then obviously there would be really no substance to it. I think the BRICS should be a proactive group in its own right, not merely seen as being reactive to what the West has been done. It should be championing the global justice of the developing world. It should be making sure that we do not, when the West coughs, to put it that way, we do not always catch the wind in the developing world. I think that will really present the BRICS as something that has substance in itself, rather than something that devoid of the G7 as an objective, then it would lose its rationale for existence.
Okay, well, Wesley, Russia's President Vladimir Putin, addressing the summit, has talked about the potential of BRICS and has said that based on PPP, the BRICS countries are already ahead of the G7 countries. He also talked about the de-dollarization process that you mentioned already, picking up speed. I want your thoughts expanding on these comments.
Well, I think that this is exactly what the West has been dreading about the summit. There has been lots, both internationally and locally in South Africa, there has been a lot of talk about the Putin question. President Putin's presence and his absence at the summit has been dogging our headlines for the last couple of months. But I think that his video, I mean, there was, when he addressed, when the video was played, there was an audible, resounding applause within the hall and within the venue. And that indicates that President Putin himself is very popular in South Africa, despite the mainstream media, both Western and locally. And so I think that what he has announced is precisely what the West has been dreading, that BRICS countries are on a path. And what certainly doesn't help the West, at least, is that you have these other countries like Iran, for example, who are saying, we want to join you, we want to get integrated. And I think that this is what BRICS leaders are certainly in favor of, a leveling of the playing fields, especially as far as the global economy is concerned, a de-dollarization process, alternatives to the Bretton Woods institutions. So, for example, the strategic role played by the New Development Bank. And I think that these institutions that BRICS is certainly setting up is certainly questioning or at least pulling the mat out under the West, which has been in place for the last 60, 70 years. So I think that, again, the potential that you ask about is great, especially for the Global South. I think that for the first time, what is practically happening is that we are not just having conferences, we are not just having our leaders are simply not just meeting and going back home and nothing changes, but for the first time actually in history, these changes are happening at a global level. And this is to the disdain of the West. And I think that certainly that potential lies there. And I think that we need to, as people on the ground, sitting in our homes, we must certainly start working with each other. I think that that is what's important. And so the people-to-people relations that happens as well must take place so that these relations can strengthen.
I want to pick up right what you said, Wesley, because you said that for the first time, instead of just having conferences and just talking, that there's actions, there's movement. Just staying with you, Wesley, do you think that a big part of that, actually the situation that happened with the Russian-Ukraine war, confiscation of Russian funds, more illegal sanctions put on various countries, do you think that the West actually caused this situation to be expedited even more?
Well, I do think so. I think so. I don't think that they actually realized that. Yes, it's a very good way of putting it. So you're absolutely right. I think that the arrogance of NATO, for example, in expansion and going into Ukraine or recruiting Ukraine, has certainly unlocked a number of these processes and BRICS just becoming a bit more stronger. And I think that that has certainly worked in the favor of developing countries such as China and India, no doubt. I think that their economies are thriving because of, as it were, the crisis that is happening. So I think that you're absolutely right. I don't think that the West has actually realized that they have, to a large extent, contributed to this, for lack of a better word, solidarity among the Global South in saying that we will no longer be bullied by you. Note, of course, that Africans themselves have a very bad experience of NATO, and especially what NATO did in 2011 in Libya. And so our memories are not short as far as what NATO even did on our own continent, and that's what's important. And so certainly you are absolutely right. I think that the West has not realized yet, at least, well, maybe some of them have, that they've contributed largely to these developments that are happening within the Global South, and the Global South just rallying together and saying that we will stick together and we will make sure that we sort out